welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Sports writer for The Nation magazine, Dave Zirin, joins us to discuss the exploding protests by NFL players who follow the example of Colin Kaepernick against the police killing of black men, and Donald Trump's suggestion that those who take a knee during the national anthem should be fired. This after Trump called them SOBs. And we hear the main part of the presentation to the 72nd UN General Assembly by the Honorable Mark Anthony Brantley, Minister of Foreign Affairs of St. Kitts. He lays out the impact and implications of the devastation in the Caribbean region as a result of Hurricanes Irma and Maria, and lays out the reality of global warming. Mexico City-based Laura Carlson joins us to discuss what is happening on the ground, the impact of three major earthquakes to have hit that country in the last few weeks. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Healthcare advocates are breathing a sigh of relief after Maine Senator Susan Collins became the third Republican to promise a vote against the latest Republican attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Speaking to CNN, Collins cited her concerns about insurance rates for people with pre-existing conditions and the massive cuts that would be made to the Medicaid program.
It would have changed the program in a way that would have put health care at risk for some of our most vulnerable citizens, including disabled children and low-income seniors, by cutting $1 trillion out of the program from the years 2020 to 2036.
Collins said she made her decision despite a phone call from Donald Trump. Three Republican no votes would doom the bill. Along with Collins, Arizona's John McCain and Kentucky's Rand Paul have announced their oppositions. Republicans held their one and only hearing on the Graham-Cassidy legislation. The hearing was delayed as disability rights activists with the group ADAPT filled the chamber and chanted, "No cuts to Medicaid, save our liberty." Capitol Police announced 181 arrests. Donald Trump is up and tweeting again this morning on the issue of NFL players who kneel during the national anthem to protest racial injustice. Trump tweeted, quote, "The issue of kneeling has nothing to do with race. It is about respect for our country, flag, and national anthem. NFL must respect this." It's his fifth day of addressing the issue. White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders yesterday denied Trump was trying to fan the flames of the culture wars.
The president's not talking about race. The president's talking about pride in our country.
NBA All-Star LeBron James followed on his comments when he called Trump "you bum." He said that Trump doesn't understand how many children look up to the president of the U.S. for guidance, leadership, and words of encouragement. James said, "That's what makes me sick more than anything.
I'm not going to let, while I have this platform, to let one individual, no matter the power, no matter the impact that he should have or she should have, ever use sport as a platform to divide us."
On Twitter and elsewhere, Trump drew criticism for focusing on the issue of kneeling during the national anthem while failing to address the devastation suffered by 3.5 million U.S. citizens in Puerto Rico and the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. One typical Twitter comment addressed to Trump, quote, "You know who didn't watch a lot of football this weekend? Puerto Rico. Help them, you inept, sorry excuse for a president." When Trump finally responded yesterday, 5 days after the storm hit, he seemed to blame Puerto Rico for its own troubles. Trump tweeted, Texas and Florida are doing great, but Puerto Rico, which was already suffering from broken infrastructure and massive debt, is in deep trouble. Trump also claimed that, quote, food, water, and medical are top priorities and doing well. Puerto Rico's governor has warned the island is on the brink of a humanitarian crisis. North Korea's top diplomat says that Donald Trump's tweet that leader Kim Jong-un won't be around much longer was a declaration of war against his country. Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho told reporters Trump's declaration gives North Korea every right under the United Nations Charter to take countermeasures, including the right to shoot down U.S. strategic bombers, even if they're not yet inside North Korean airspace.
As you already know, for the last few days, the UN and the international society sincerely wish the war of words between the DPRK and the United States does not turn into a real action. However, last weekend, Trump claimed our leadership wouldn't be around much longer, and hence, at last, he declared a war on our country.
White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders said afterwards the U.S. has not declared war on North Korea. The Trump administration also said it's not seeking to overthrow North Korea's government, despite Trump's tweet that Kim Jong-un won't be around much longer. The big box retailer Target says it will raise its minimum wage to $15 an hour by the year 2020. Target's minimum has been $10 an hour. It will rise to $11 by next month. Target said the wage increases will apply to the 100,000 temporary workers the retailer plans to hire for the holidays. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth on Sunday, September 24th, 2017, an historic day for the National Football League. More than 200 players, including some coaches from football teams across the league, silently protested during the U.S. national anthem, a show of solidarity for Colin Kaepernick and others who've done the same in the name of Black Lives, and a show of resistance to the recent words of Trump. Now, Colin Kaepernick began sitting during pregame national anthems in August of 2016 as a quarterback for the 49ers. He explained to NFL media last August while he was on the San Francisco 49ers, quote, "I'm not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses Black people and people of color. To me, this is bigger than football, and it would be selfish on my part to look the other way. There are bodies on the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder." And he became a free agent after the 2016 season and has not yet been picked up by a new team, which many see as punishment for being vocal about race and police brutality. At a rally on Friday, Donald Trump encouraged NFL owners to punish their players for acts of peaceful protests. Let us go to hear what Trump had to say now.
Luther and I, and everyone in this arena tonight, are unified by the same great American values. We're proud of our country. We respect our flag. Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, "Get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired."
The next day, Donald Trump doubled down on his words in a tweet saying, quote, "If a player wants the privilege of making millions of dollars in the NFL or other leagues, he or she should not be allowed to disrespect our great American flag or country and should stand for the national anthem. If not, you're fired. Find something else to do." His words, a thinly veiled attack, not only on Colin Kaepernick, but also on all of the players that participated in the protest. Now, Trump is clearly fueling racial divisions, and many Black athletes stood up to Trump. LeBron James notably said in a video he's now using sports as a platform to divide us, adding, "It's not something that I can stand for, and it's not something I can be quiet about." Let us go now to a clip from ESPN with players speaking out.
It's powerful what all these athletes are doing. You know, we even had the first baseball player to do it two nights ago, I believe, wasn't it? Two nights ago? That's phenomenal.
Hopefully we do something as a league that gives us strength. I thought what the NFL is doing right now is beautiful.
It is about equality and people having the option and the freedom to speak upon things that they feel that's not unjust.
It's been great to see all athletes unite.
We're face of a lot of brands. We can use that platform to kind of catapult what's going on. That's where we can make our mark on.
We still have problems just like everybody else. And when we have those problems, we have to figure out a way how we come together and be as great as we can be as a people.
If you don't believe in it, don't stand for it. But if you believe in something, you should believe in what you should stand for what you believe in. And I think that's kind of, you know, what this whole thing has been about.
I salute Colin Kaepernick for being as powerful as he was and being the one that he had to fall on the sword, unfortunately. And I hate that. And I hope that some NFL owner, I wish I owned an NFL team right now, I'll sign him today.
I was proud of all the players. Mm-hmm. You know, Steph Curry, LeBron, all of them came and really supported each other.
If it go away, then we still have a problem. So I hope it's not going away in a few weeks.
I commend these guys, and I commend everybody that's just trying to make a difference.
All righty. And those were players from the NBA, including LeBron James, Magic Johnson, and others. And this past Sunday, many players kneel, sat, or stood locking arms during the anthem. Three teams even stayed in the locker room, not coming out for the anthem at all. Now, discuss all of this. I'd like to welcome Dave Zirin. Dave is the sports correspondent for The Nation magazine and author of Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. He's been named one of Anthony Reeder's 50 Visionaries Who Are Changing Our World. Dave Zirin is a frequent guest on MSNBC, ESPN, and other outlets. He also hosts his own weekly SiriusXM show, Edge of Sports Radio, and co-hosts The Collision on our sister station, Pacifica Radio's WPFW in Washington, D.C. Other books include What's My Name, Fool? A People's History of Sports in the United States, and Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. He's written extensively about Colin Kaepernick and the NFL protest. Dave, welcome.
Hey, it's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Dave, good to see you again. I think last time I saw you, we were both freezing in Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Day, co-hosting a national broadcast for Pacifica Radio. So, Dave, a lot has been said about what Trump had to say, right, and as insulting to the players. And I'll have to say, as a mother and as a woman, I take particular offense of this son of a bitch thing, because he, in making that statement, he not only was racist, but he was also sexist, slamming the mothers of these players, but also women. Dave, your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I've been highlighting a great deal when speaking about this, because it was with that line that I believe that Trump really did cross a Rubicon. Maybe not with the owners. I think with the NFL owners, many of whom backed Trump to the tune of millions of dollars during the campaign, I think for them, Trump crossed the Rubicon when he attacked the profits of the sport itself, calling for people to boycott, criticizing the play, saying the NFL has gotten too soft. I mean, billionaires do not like also being told who to hire and fire. So for them, that was their motivation. But for the players, that SOB line was really, really toxic, because if you've ever been in an NFL locker room, as I have, beyond the misogyny, beyond the disrespect, beyond how incomprehensibly vulgar it is for the president of the United States to be saying such things, you got to understand that the mother in an NFL locker room is actually kind of a very special position. I mean, NFL locker rooms are more close-knit than other sports. Maybe it's because of the violence of the sport. Maybe it's because of the CTE. Maybe it's for reasons that a lot of listeners might find very disturbing. But however the reasons, and whatever the reasons, the locker room truly is what they call a brotherhood. And in the brotherhood, one player's mom is everybody's player's mom. And so when you talk about mothers, I mean, my goodness, you know, I mean, it cuts so deeply. I mean, I keep thinking about Penny Bennett. That's the mother of Michael and Martellus Bennett, two very outspoken players. And I'm doing a book with Michael Bennett right now. So I've gotten to know the Bennett family and I've gotten to meet Penny. Penny Bennett is somebody who's a public school teacher for over 20 years. And she is like a mother to so many of these players. And Michael holds her so close to his heart, and so does Martellus, that when Trump, for all of his comments about everything, about getting fired, lose your job, all this stuff, for Michael and Martellus, it was that B word, which stood out so starkly among the entire stream of vituperation that came from Trump. So it's just important to keep in mind that NFL players are also very highly attuned to the misogyny in that statement and the overlapping misogyny and racism of Trump's comments.
Yeah, you know, I was really encouraged too in that last clip. I think it was LeBron James who mentioned Colin, because he was really out there, not by himself. I mean, there were a few others who took a knee in the tradition of Martin Luther King. But I was quite struck. I'm quite struck by a lot of the mainstream media analysts who are saying, well, we're confused. What are they really protesting about? Are they protesting Trump's words? Or are they standing in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick, who clearly took a position against the police killing of black men? And for some reason, they can't seem to get it in their heads that they're doing both, right? And also that you have written about the history of athletes protesting, Dave.
Yeah, no, that's, and you know, it's so interesting you say that, because as I'm was waiting even to do this interview, I'm writing an article right now that's called "Taking a Knee Is Not About NFL Unity, But About Racial Justice." And it's so important that this not get lost in this conversation. That, you know, because Donald Trump, one of the things that he does is he has this sickening narcissism where everything has to be about him. He's such an avatar of our 21st century obsession with celebrity, absence of substance. And so all there is this kind of hatred and this narcissism and this idea that only if they spell your name right, it doesn't matter what they say about you. And that the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference. And that's the great fear, is indifference. And yet while we have this discussion about Trump and the NFL and unity and resistance and all the rest of it, we forget the names Alton Sterling or Philando Castile or Michael Brown. These are the names, or Sandra Bland. These are the names that brought NFL players to their knees last year. And this is why Colin Kaepernick is not in the league, because he wanted to raise the profile about white supremacy and racist violence. Or take someone like Michael Bennett, for example. Michael Bennett continued the protests in the NFL preseason in August. Now, while Michael Bennett is a friend of Colin Kaepernick, he wasn't sitting down during the anthem because Colin wasn't in the league, even though that upset him. He was motivated to do so because there was a woman in Seattle named Charlena Lyles who called the police to her home because she thought she might have an intruder who was an ex-boyfriend who had committed violence against women, against her in the past, sexual assault, and the police came and ended up killing her. For reasons that we still don't understand, 7 bullets, 4 in her back, in front of her children. This woman weighed less than 100 pounds. And Michael Bennett got to know her and got to know her family. I should say he didn't get to know her. He got to know her family. He organized a march for them. He's helping them like do things like get their groceries. He's invited them to the Seattle training camp. This is why Michael Bennett took a seat, not because of some sort of anti-Trumpian abstract unity, but because of the realities of white supremacist and police violence.
That's right. And, you know, the thing about it is, and perhaps where I want to push the envelope a little bit in terms of what Trump's calculation, because, you know, there's this general view that Trump really doesn't know what he's doing and he miscalculates and when he says things. And frankly speaking, I think that he was thought about and very pointedly made this statement during this speech in Alabama, the Deep South. And what he was doing, he was throwing more red meat to his base, as he did with the Charlottesville comment, which he has doubled down on. So it's not that he really miscalculated. He calculated right. And with everything going on with North Korea, also as things are closing in on him in terms of the investigation of him and his administration and Kushner, his son-in-law, and the rest of it, you know, he needs to keep throwing red meat to them to let them know, you know what, those of you who are white supremacists, I am one of you. You know what I mean, Dave?
You know, no, I agree with you, and I agree with you up to a point. I have a slight disagreement with you, because I agree with you without question that it was calculated. I agree with you without question that it was an act of divisive red meat to an all-white Alabama audience. I agree with you that he thought that black dissenting NFL players would be the perfect target for that audience. I agree with all of that. But I also think that he miscalculated, because he did not realize that it would also mean causing this incredible eruption of resistance on Sunday.
Right. Remember, he didn't expect the strength of the reaction.
Oh, no. He didn't, you know, because Donald Trump never played football. So he doesn't understand what I was talking about earlier about this brotherhood that exists. So even though a ton of NFL players may not agree with Colin Kaepernick, many of them even voted for Donald Trump. But when you attack somebody in the brotherhood, when you threaten their livelihoods, when you talk about people's mothers, you know, then it goes way above and beyond, oh, I've got this targeted group of people that I can demonize. I think Trump totally overstepped. Think about it like this. He called upon the people he thought were his friends and allies, NFL owners, the fire players who were sitting down. I think he expected maybe a player to get fired this weekend. I think he expected players to be scared this weekend. Yeah. I truly think that was part of the calculation. And instead, he had owners, right-wing, horrible, racist owners, some of them, openly racist, I would argue, actually linking arms with players. Now, I have a lot of issues with what their motivations might have been. But just to be very clear, I do not think that Donald Trump expected that to be the result of what should go down in ignominious history as the Huntsville, Alabama speech.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. And it remains to be seen what's going to happen next, you know, Sunday. I mean, we know what happened with Muhammad Ali, right, when he protested against the Vietnam War. John Carlos and Tommy Smith, you know, raising the fists at the Olympic Games while standing on the podium. I mean, definitely leaves, you know, that kind of legacy and that kind of impression. And the idea of people saying, well, you know what, I just want to go to, you know, a game and, you know, politics shouldn't be involved in sports. I mean, give me a break. Politics has always been in sports, at least discrimination against black players, players of color. And I guess folks aren't, you know, used to, as you say, the kind of reaction that they are now getting and the kind of support they're getting. I mean, I saw a poll that's old that said the majority of people, you know, don't think that they should take a knee during the national anthem. By the way, the vast majority of black people, even in that old poll, like 74%, they says, yeah, of course they should. So we'll see what recent polls are saying. But given the fact now that you've got basketball players coming out, and I think at least one baseball player took a knee, are you hearing the scuttlebutt? Is this thing going to spread also to other games and perhaps continue? Or you think this is going to die down by the end of this week?
you know, it's so interesting because, I mean, will it die down? Will it not die down? You know, a lot of this really does depend on other factors. It depends on, you know, whether or not Trump will be distracted by something else, you know, like a cat chasing a laser pointer. I think that other things like the March for Racial Justice on September 30th, that's going to happen in D.C. and I know in cities on the West Coast, like, let's see how big those are. I think that's going to have an effect on this. And I think, you know, the NBA, I think it's going to be very interesting because unlike the NFL, the NBA actually does have rules about standing for the national anthem. Mm. But technically, nobody in the NFL is breaking a rule by sitting or staying in the locker room or stretching or doing a handstand. I mean, people could juggle old USSR flags if they wanted to during the national anthem, and they're not actually breaking an NFL rule, but the NBA actually does have rules. So let's see if those rules become broken in the NBA and whether the progressive, you have to say, progressive commissioner of the NBA, Adam Silver, does some, I mean, when I say progressive, I mean by commissioner standards, not by, you know, Pacifica Radio standards, but whether that commissioner actually cracks down on them or not. I mean, so there are all sorts of factors at play. But one thing is certain is I truly do believe that, to paraphrase my friend John Carlos, 1968 Olympian, a tremendous stone was thrown in the water on Sunday. And we don't really know yet. It's way too early to know where those ripples are going to go.
Right. And some of this was multiracial. I mean, I saw some white players kneeling, you know, and then Trump
were several white players who took a knee. That is correct.
And then Trump tried to say, oh, the linking of arms is OK. That's actually patriotic, you know, and really denying that that was also a form of protest, you know, trying to.
And you know, he also he didn't just do that. He also said when confronted by a reporter, when he wasn't just, you know, with his iPhone tweeting, he said that, no, he wasn't calling for a boycott. No, no, of course not. And that to me just, it says so much about that, you know, that he realized he overstepped.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's gotten his wings clipped about this.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
And it's worth pointing that out.
Yeah, and lying as per usual. Dave, we're out of time for this, but for our audience in D.C., Sojourner Truth is also on the same D.C. station you're on. When does your show come on that people could tune in?
Oh, thanks for asking. And, of course, as you know, people can listen to it online at WPFW. Just go to the website there, or it's available to be podcast at iTunes.
Right.
And we air on WPFW 89.3 FM at 10 a.m. on Thursdays.
10 a.m. on Thursdays. Well, we'll certainly post that, but also encourage people to really read your series of articles in The Nation magazine, always inspiring. And Dave, this is a moment for you to be out there because you've been writing about this sort of thing for so very long. And we'll see if Kaepernick gets a job now, right? We'll have to see how that goes. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take our station break. And when we return, the disasters in the Caribbean region, as well as in Mexico. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Late great Bob Marley's Down Presser Man. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear it in its entirety, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. And we're also on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott, and on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners throughout the Caribbean region. And we have been covering the tragedies, the devastation that has happened in the Caribbean region. Now Puerto Rico pleading for federal help to recover from Hurricane Maria. A lot of devastation there, and we'll have more detail on that during another show. But the foreign minister of the island of St. Kitts gave the Honorable Mr. Mark Anthony Brantley, St. Kitts and Nevis Minister of Foreign Affairs. He spoke at the 72nd UN session, General Assembly session. And I want you to hear part of it, because the depth of the destruction that happened in the region and also the connection with global warming has been underestimated, because we hear about Barbuda, we hear about the U.S. Virgin Islands, we got a little bit of information about Cuba, now about Puerto Rico, but there were around at least 15 islands that were in the Caribbean that were hit by this. Let us go now to hear what the Honorable Mr. Mark Anthony Brantley from the Caribbean region had to say.
Mr. President, the world has gathered here in New York at this 72nd General Assembly under the theme focusing on people, striving for peace and a decent life for all on a sustainable planet. The theme is comprehensive yet simple, concise yet inclusive, and it encompasses pivotal and pertinent areas for international reflection at this critical juncture in our history. Mr. President, permit me to begin where the theme ends, sustainable planet. I choose to do so, Mr. President, because of the experience that I and members of our Caribbean civilization had immediately prior to leaving our countries to attend this General Assembly. In the space of 2 weeks, we braced ourselves for three hurricanes, Irma, Jose, and Maria. Two of these, Irma and Maria, descended on our region as Category 5 hurricanes, and in the case of Irma, the most powerful storm in recorded history in the Atlantic. I pause to reflect, Mr. President, that the hurricane season for 2017 is not yet over, and the Caribbean will face similar threats each and every year. In the aftermath, we were faced with the tragic destruction of life, property, and infrastructure in Antigua and Barbuda, in Anguilla, in St. Bartholomew, in St. Martin, in St. Martin, the British Virgin Islands, the U.S. Virgin Islands, in Cuba, the Turks and Caicos Islands, Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, Guadeloupe, and Dominica. Irma then made landfall in Florida in the United States, where, like Hurricane Harvey before it in Texas and Louisiana, damage and destruction was caused to millions of people. Mr. President, I have highlighted the various countries and territories that suffered the most devastation, but my own beloved country of St. Kitts and Nevis was not without injury. We too saw damage to our power grid, our roads, our agriculture and fisheries sector, and the homes of our people. Indeed, on September 19th, the day when we should have been celebrating our 34th anniversary of independence as a nation, St. Kitts and Nevis was locked down under assault from Hurricane Maria. Mr. President, the carnage in a wide swath of the Caribbean is unimaginable. Lives have been lost, homes and infrastructure destroyed, economies reduced to tatters, years of development wiped out, and in the case of Barbuda, an entire island evacuated and rendered uninhabited and uninhabitable for the first time in 300 years. It is worthy of note, Mr. President, that a carnage caused by Hurricanes Irma and Maria took but a few days. In just a few days, and in many countries a mere few hours, the world had front row seats to the most horrific destruction ever seen in our beloved Caribbean region. We have in this very chamber heard the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda speak solemnly to the utter destruction of Barbuda. We have only today stood in anguished silence as the Prime Minister of Dominica recounted the near total destruction of his beautiful country and the tragic loss of life. Their first-hand accounts, Mr. President, would move even the coldest hearts to tears. We today extend our deep condolences to our brothers and sisters and continue to keep them in our prayers. But even as we do so, Mr. President, we also remember victims of the not one, not two, but three horrific earthquakes in Mexico and those in Japan and in New Zealand. Our thoughts and prayers are also with the government and people of these countries. Mr. President, the time has now come for the world to treat these phenomena not as natural disasters, but as the man-made disasters that they are. The science is irrefutable. Our oceans continue to get warmer due to our continued abuse of our planet Earth. Warmer oceans feed and create horrific storms such as Irma and Maria. Now more than ever, we bear witness to the compelling need to support the call for reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and all other actions and behaviors that aggravate the effects of climate change. Mr. President, climate change for us in the Caribbean is not a matter for academic rumination. The humanitarian crisis unfolding in the Caribbean in the wake of Hurricanes Irma and Maria is stark testimony that climate change is not only real, but poses an existential threat to our people, our countries, and our civilization. The world has deliberated and negotiated. We have made commitments and signed multiple agreements, most recently the Paris Agreement, but the time for more urgent, concrete, tangible, and collective action is now. Mr. President, it is the most cruel irony of our times that those of us in the Caribbean least responsible for climate change are the ones most disastrously affected by it. We are not major polluters, but we bear the brunt of the effects of such pollution. In every sense, Mr. President, small, vulnerable states like Antigua and Barbuda, like Dominica, and like my own St. Kitts and Nevis, continue to be asked by the world to cash a check we did not write. In order to attain a sustainable planet, those most responsible for climate change, through their greenhouse gas emissions and other environmentally harmful practices, must shoulder the responsibility of arresting and ameliorating the consequences. We cannot continue to abuse our planet and expect to remain unscathed. The people of St. Kitts and Nevis call upon the global community to pledge itself to pursuing renewable energy with greater alacrity. We must invest in better and stronger homes and buildings. We must grow our economies to allow us greater financial resilience and flexibility. The people of St. Kitts and Nevis and of our Caribbean deserve and demand the same fundamental right to life and the security of our way of life as others anywhere else. I ask the global community to lend their collective voices so that together we can create a glorious symphony for change. That change which ensures a sustainable planet for all. In this regard, I call on the community of nations to mobilize the necessary resources to ensure the speedy reconstruction of those countries devastated by Hurricanes Irma and Maria. Mr. President, my delegation condemns unreservedly the sterile analysis of GDP per capita, which has been used by international agencies to tell our small island developing states that we are now middle and high income countries and therefore locked out of accessing developmental assistance or affordable financing. Mr. President, it is a travesty and a tragedy for the world community to witness such destruction caused by forces entirely outside the control of Caribbean nations and then refuse to allow those very nations access to the necessary resources to rebuild. There has to be a more sensible and just model which takes into account the special vulnerability of small island states. St. Kitts and Nevis therefore joins others in demanding that a vulnerability index be developed as part of the matrix for accessing developmental assistance. We of the Caribbean, already caught in the debt trap, cannot, after each disaster, be forced to borrow commercially at high interest rates to rebuild destroyed lives. This is and must be a moral imperative for us all in the wake of the destruction seen in the Caribbean. And rebuild we must, Mr. President. Countries such as Dominica have no safe zones or the geographic areas to which populations can be relocated. A hurricane of the scale of Irma and Maria devastates entire countries. We of the Caribbean are a proud and resilient people. The world must not stand by and allow the evils of climate change to force Caribbean people to become climate refugees. We must rebuild, and we require the community of nations to partner with us in this rebuilding effort. In the fight against the disastrous effects of climate change, allow me to congratulate the work of many international agencies and organizations, as well as non-governmental actors. My country is especially heartened, Mr. President, with the work being undertaken by the Commonwealth and its leadership. Mr. President, it follows that if we are to achieve a sustainable planet, it requires an all-hands-on-deck approach. From the onset, there must be buy-in from all stakeholders. No one should be left out, and therefore it calls for inclusiveness, unity, and appreciating the input and contributions that all can make to achieve in the world we want. This brings me to the first part of our theme, focusing on people. There can be no debate that our people are our primary resource. It is no marvel, therefore, that governments allocate a large percentage of their budgets to develop their human capital and expend great effort to ensure that they meet the basic needs of their populace. Governments which fail to provide for their people and who ill-treat, abuse, and oppress their people must be rightly ostracized by the international community. Mr. President, our world comprises all kinds of people, but I wish to highlight the youth, that sector of all of our populations on which the global community must increase its focus. I commend the United Nations on its unflinching efforts to draw attention to our youth. Indeed, it was over two decades ago that the UN General Assembly adopted the World Program of Action for Youth to the year 2000 and beyond. Youth constitute 18% of the global population. Youth and children together account for nearly 40% of the world's population. The youth, Mr. President, are not just our future, they are our present. Globally, governments must do all they can to provide institutions and opportunities for learning and development, create employment as well as to prepare and to steer the youth towards entrepreneurial endeavors. But governments cannot do it alone. We therefore use this forum to call upon the business community, as well as non-governmental agencies and actors, to provide our youth with viable options and opportunities for gainful employment and social and economic advancement. Mr. President, we cannot speak of attaining the Sustainable Development Goals without a focus on our youths. Mr. President, a vital element of sustainable planet is peace. It behooves us all, nations great and small, to work towards the achievement of this essential universal value. Regrettably, Mr. President, while in some countries their citizens are forced to engage in a daily struggle for survival, braving the scorching sun and bitter cold to labor for less than US$1 per day, other countries are expending billions of dollars on developing weapons of war and mass destruction. While some governments are allocating large sums to secure a future for their women and youth, others are investing in tools of war. Whilst the budgets alone of some governments will be inadequate to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, others are using multiple times these budgets in developing nuclear warheads. Mr. President, in order to obtain a sustainable planet, our priorities must be synchronized, harmonized, and synergized. Our goal must be preservation and conservation, not only of our natural resources, but also of our human resources. My delegation condemns unreservedly the actions which have led to heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula and calls on all countries to respect and honor their solemn commitments under international law. We condemn all actions that encourage violence and disrupt peace. There can be no place in today's world for war and violence. We therefore join the international community in demanding diplomacy and dialogue instead of saber rattling and war mongering. St. Kitts and Nevis stands proudly with our Caribbean and Latin American neighbors as a zone of peace, and we exhort all members of the community of nations to expend every effort to create and promote peace. Mr. President, the theme makes a clarion call not only to strive for peace, but also for a decent life for all. No boy, no girl, no man, no woman, no person should be left behind. We must work together to reduce poverty and hunger, promote justice and equality, and ensure our people have access to health care and economic opportunity. In this global effort, we must be inclusive, and each and every country must be allowed to play its part. No one nation can do it alone. Human suffering, Mr. President, anywhere is human suffering everywhere. We must build partnerships and ensure the contribution of all of the populations of this, our planet Earth. All must be allowed to sit at the table of brotherhood and contribute to finding lasting solutions to the problems that we face. In this regard, we call on the international community yet again to look at our dear friend Taiwan. This modern country of 23 million people, a country that has had tremendous successes in technology, agriculture, health, and renewable energy, a country which is a model of peace and security. St. Kitts and Nevis has experienced firsthand the benefits of a partnership with Taiwan. There's much that they can offer, and we lose collectively when we seek to isolate and prevent our fellow nations from having a seat at the international table. St. Kitts and Nevis continues its unwavering support for the government and people of the Republic of China, Taiwan, to be included in the United Nations and other international agencies. There's much we can learn from Taiwan, and we can no longer afford to ignore the voices of their 23 million people. In equal measure, we call yet again for the lifting of the over 50-year embargo against our Caribbean sister, Cuba. Mr. President, the Cuban people are a noble people who have demonstrated their resilience despite insurmountable odds. Their leadership in health and humanitarian assistance to Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America is well known. Their people ask only to be given a fair chance to live their lives in dignity and in peace. In closing, Mr. President, I acknowledge that the task ahead of navigating the many complex issues of the international community will not be easy. We, however, remain a firm believer in collective strength and of collective effort. This journey to a sustainable planet and future for all is attainable. Throughout history, we have achieved more together than we have ever achieved alone. Whether we are small islands, landlocked, mountain, desert, or ice-capped states, whether we are superpowers or powerless, we are all better, and the United Nations becomes a better organization when we work together. Alone, we can do little, but together, we can achieve much. The challenges we face globally, from climate change to refugees to war and violence, require urgent action now. The world does not have the luxury of time. We have talked, we have debated, we have postulated and hypothesized, we have studied and analyzed. We must now act. In this regard, Mr. President, I can find no more elegant prose than that of American civil rights leader Martin Luther King, Jr. And he said this: "We are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. This is no time for apathy or complacency. This is a time for vigorous and positive action.
All righty, there you go. And Laura Carlson, based in Mexico City. Laura, you have been listening to this, really laying out the reality of what these disasters have meant for the Caribbean region. And I'm sure you've been putting that together with what you are facing now on the ground in Mexico. Laura Carlson, welcome.
That was a fantastic speech, and it certainly resonates with what we're seeing. In the case of the earthquakes in Mexico, you can't necessarily ascribe that to climate change. You know, you can't, in the same way on the hurricanes. But there's still a number of points that he makes that are very, very important for understanding what's happening in Mexico, too, as well as taking into account that Mexico is also vulnerable to the increase in hurricanes at any time. One of the things is that these are wake-up calls. These are wake-up calls about changing the whole, many of the systems of how we live. He speaks about global warming and the immediate need to stop the gases that cause it, and the unfairness of the fact that the Caribbean countries basically are having to pay a check they didn't write, as he says. That's one part of it. And the other part of it is that in Mexico City, what we're seeing is that when the rubble comes down and it buries the bodies and it buries the schools and the buildings and the apartments that people lived in, it also exposes a lot. What it exposes and what it's exposing in Mexico City is the corruption of the system. Buildings that were built substandard in terms of the building codes, knowing that we live in a seismic region. The government actions that are more concerned with trying to make political hay of the tragedy than with actually getting aid where it's needed. And then the fact that there is this amazing society that in, from 1 minute to the next began to pitch in and take over what really needed to be done. And there you have the point that he made so strongly about the role of youth, and that's something that we're really seeing here.
Yeah, and Laura Carlson, first of all, our sympathy goes out to everybody across the country in Mexico, those who have lost loved ones, and we're frantically trying to find out where is the best place for people who want to help, who provide some aid, what they should do. We already posted one outfit, I think, in Los Angeles on our website. But I also read an article from Reuters that says relief supplies are basically piling up at upscale districts in Mexico City, right? That the wealthy neighborhoods of Roma and Condesa in the center of Mexico City, that they're seeing, you know, a lot of aid there, and that in the more impoverished, far-flung neighborhoods in the outskirts of the capital, that aid and comfort less abundant.
Yeah, I think it's mostly a problem of geography, and they're beginning to resolve that by having the social networks are playing a big role by saying where and what is needed at different places. There's also the same problem exists in terms of what kind of aid is arriving. You'll have a donation center where they're just drowning in clothes, you know, but they need bandages or batteries, kinds of things that people don't necessarily think of. So I don't think it's a class-based response so much. People want the aid to get where it's most needed, but they're just trying to figure out still the kinds of systems that are needed. So in Xochimilco, in the southern part of the city, for example, it took a while for the aid to get really to get down there. But what's happening now is that the students, especially at the National University, have created an enormous center for donations and aid out of the entire football stadium or soccer stadium. And they're dividing it up, and they're trying to keep tabs on where to get that aid. So it's beginning to level out a little bit. The aid will still be needed. You know, there's not, in the long-term sense, an excess of donations, because what has to be taken into account is there are literally thousands of people who are homeless. In addition to the 40-some buildings that collapsed in Mexico City, there's an estimated 500 buildings that have been evacuated, and according to the city government and the architects who reviewed them, will have to be demolished, completely demolished. Mm. And then there's a much larger number that will have to be repaired, structurally repaired, for people to be able to live in them. So there's going to be a lot of need in the medium and long term as well.
Right, and we are hearing 319 people killed thus far in Mexico City and surrounding states, that there's still some hope of, you know, finding some survivors. But one of the things I was quite struck by, and the little, you're not really seeing as the coverage in mainstream media here in the U.S. as one would think should happen for our neighboring Mexico there. But the volunteers, people from community, I mean, have been amazing. Tell us a little bit about that effort, because when tragedy happens in the U.S., of course, people get out and help, et cetera. But it seems as though people in Mexico are taking it to another level, Laura.
Absolutely. There have been a number of statements from experts that have come in from others, from other countries, or even foreigners that live in Mexico City, and that have experienced, say, a natural disaster, an earthquake in their countries of origin. And there's a consensus that nobody has ever seen anything like this. Mexican society has always had a deep sense of the collective, but in the general course of life, particularly within a big city that's like any other big city, people go about their business, pretty much taking care of themselves and perhaps their immediate family and loved ones. In this case, you just suddenly had this sense of this is our city and we will save it. And every person, known or unknown, who's been affected by this deserves aid, and it's my personal responsibility to do something. So people have stepped up, and like I say, particularly young people, they're pulling brigades of hours and hours of hauling rubble out of sites to see if they're survivors. They are organizing the donations, like in the stadium and also in literally hundreds of points across the city, to be able to get the aid where it's needed, not just in Mexico City, but in the southern states of Puebla and Morelos and the other places, the little towns been hit too, because they don't want those to be forgotten. So people are keeping tabs on it through social media. It's changed their lives in ways that has and will change Mexican society. To know that in the tweet, in fact, that was particularly notable from a young person said, yeah, everyone says the millennials are apathetic and egotistical and all we do is hang out on social media. And then there was a picture of a human chain of college students, you know, working to bring the aid where it was needed, and said, now what do you have to say about us? And it's true. It broke the stereotype and completely changed people's ideas of youth these days. And I think it's completely changed the lives of the young people who are involved.
Right. Well, Laura Carlson, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. I'm glad to know that you and your family are okay. Were you actually in Mexico City at the time of the quake? I know you travel quite a bit with your work. Yeah. How frightening.
Really strongly. It was terrifying.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Laura, we hope that everything will now quiet down, and we will certainly be in touch with you to see if you would be available to be on our roundtable this coming Friday. And we're glad that you and your family are safe, and it's really uplifting to see the collective effort made by all segments of society, as you say, in a lot of young people in Mexico. It's something that we could all learn from. Thank you, Laura Carlson.
So many bears. Well, thank you. My pleasure.
All righty. We're out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our longtime intern, Sherelle Withers, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, our engineer, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.